Hello.
How are you?
Fine. Just getting all set up over here, moving stuff around.
Moving stuff.
Got to be comfortable and ready because we're gonna really get into it on this one.
Are we?
Yeah, we're gonna get to it. It's gonna be an interrogation.
Is it?
I demand answers. I demand satisfaction with regards to this movie.
Okay. Well, before we get ahead of ourselves, let's
Sure.
discuss the transition from the previous month of James Cameron to the current month of Chris June Bale.
Which is an incredibly thin pun, as many people have pointed out in the Incomparable member Slack, where we kind of crowdsourced some suggestions for June related puns and things.
Yeah, I mean, there were some unfortunate situations. Like there was a suggestion of June's Bond, but none of the bonds that we wanted to talk about were readily available.
We're not going to just watch a bunch of Bond movies that we don't want to watch just because it rhymes properly.
Yeah, and then there's and I mean not readily available in that you need to buy each one of them for $15 right
Oh
now.
yeah, we're not going to do that
No.
either.
But then there was
We're not very committed to this podcast.
No. No. If there's one thing we lack, it's commitment. But the other thing on our 195th episode? Sixth?
Sixth.
Yes, sixth. I knew that. And the other thing, some of the other suggestions were like, Catherine Zeta-Jones, which was bad because we couldn't think of any good Catherine Zeta-Jones movies. Sorry.
My wife is very upset because she's the one who actually suggested Juni Mara and June Law. She thought they were great suggestions. The problem is just
Oh.
that the movie selection wasn't there,
No, not
so
really.
can't do it.
Yeah. You but with Christian Bale, you at least get, well, let's just say you have something to talk about. That's for sure. And
Yeah.
he doesn't really like do a lot of phoning it in performances, I will say.
No, he's
So
very serious.
yeah, he's very committed to his craft, and that lets us have oodles of fun discussing these things. Now, one of the things that he's probably mostly known for is, of course, American Psycho, which is a film that I believe we have suggested to one another previously and have both mutually agreed not to do for various reasons because it's very strange and difficult to discuss. Because there are a lot of violent bad things inside of the film. It can be a little awkward. And also, even if you look past the violent bad things in the film, there's just a general discussion of what the F is going on.
And
Which I
that is what I want to talk to you about
yeah.
because I don't know if I get this movie or not. And movies like this always used to make me feel dumb because I don't get it or something, or I can't see past the metaphor or the artifice or whatever. But I don't even remember who it was. Years ago, somebody pointed something out that if a movie makes you feel dumb for not getting it, it's not your fault, it's the movie's fault. So I blame the movie, and I want to know what this movie is doing. Because there are two different interpretations you can have of what is going on. And when you pick either one of those, it drastically changes your opinion of the movie and what the movie is trying to tell you and what the movie is trying to make you feel. And I don't know which one's right. And I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. So it frustrates and confuses me.
Well, let's get this first thing out of the way. This movie is very clearly saying that murder is bad. So let's
I don't think that's the confusing portion of it.
yeah, let's just make sure we get that. See, Mary Harron, the director and co-writer of this, along with her partner in crime here, Guinevere Turner, who makes a cameo in the film, they co-wrote this. They b based it heavily on the Bret Easton Ellis novel, but not conforming directly to it. It is a satire, and that was satirical as well. I personally don't care for the novel. I didn't make it very far into it before I was like, reading these things is, these intimate descriptions of things is not for me. It's a little more palatable
the
to
same
watch.
Except more graphic?
Well, but also just wordier. There's a lot more of internal monologue-y narration because it's told from his point of view. So you get a lot of stuff from his opinions about things. But that's where the things like the ridiculous food stuff and all that kind of stuff comes into the play here. But this is a satire. It's a black comedy where we are not meant to we're not meant to identify with Patrick Bateman in any way. He's not a human being for us to identify with. He is more, I don't know how to say this, a symptom of white male privilege, I guess. And we get to explore the various awful things that he can do with that. It's an interesting way to view the movie. If you check out some of her, Mary Harron's interviews, it's always been about satire for her. It was never really about this being a very serious horror movie. There are trailers that are cut by Lionsgate that make it seem like it's a very serious horror movie, which disappointed a lot of the bros, apparently, because it's not serious in that regard. It's also, I think, too graphic for most people to look past that to the satire and take the commentary that Mary Harron and Guinevere Turner had to say about men, rich and powerful, insecure men, which is what this is all about. And now what I think you're getting at is whether or not the events of the film happened or whether or not the events of the film didn't happen. And I will settle that once and for all by saying this is entirely fictional. So they didn't happen. But the interpretation of whether or not it happened seems to get people really hung up on it.
Because they spend the first, two-thirds of the movie playing it very earnest in that all of it builds, it makes sense if you see this character's perspective, take as read all of the things he's saying about how he doesn't really have a personality, he just wants to fit in, he got this job because his dad basically owns the company, all of these things, and then just by nature of the fact that he is doing his absolute best to fit in and be the best, most blandest person in his whatever social group / business, and he is seemingly not excelling at the things he's dedicating every waking moment to, it kind of like cracks his personality underneath the fake persona, and then he goes a little nuts and starts killing people while still sort of trying to pretend to be that same person, and then eventually letting it down. But the world is so self-absorbed that it doesn't care or notice that he is deeply broken and doing all of these horrible things. But apparently, if none of those things actually occurred, none of these people should really have noticed in the first place that he was acting unusual, because he's just being one of the crowd. So the whole thing being in his head means that trying to fit in and trying to be like, I don't know, the best, most generic example of all of these things that he's told are important just is an unfulfilling life that makes him daydream all day long about crazy things. And if he skips his medication for too long, he starts to lose it a little bit, but then he just eats a whole bunch of it at the end there and seems to sort of come back to who he was in the beginning.
It is my interpretation that all of these things did happen, and that the part that's messing with him is that people don't believe that these sorts of things could have happened, that he couldn't have done these things. A person like him couldn't have done these things.
Wait, this is your interpretation that they did happen, but I thought you said they didn't happen.
No, I was just saying this is a fictional movie.
Of course.
This is not a documentary.
No. I mean, we weren't really working on Wall Street in the 80s, so who knows?
I'm relatively confident that this is not a documentary.
Well, who knows if the indifference of his peer group was accurate in this movie, all of this could have happened and everyone just went about their business cleaning up the apartments and reselling them because real estate is more important than multiple murders.
And that's actually a conversation that I've had in the past. People have been like, oh, well, you know, he goes to the apartment at the end and he gets turned away. If they really knew all about it and if there really were murders, you know, they could have called the police. And it's like, well, I don't think they wanted to damage the property values. I don't think they wanted a scandal. I think it was about suppressing anything that would be wrong or anything that could be harmful to the way that society could be operating for that class of people.
They're protecting their own self-interest too. But I presumably the same thing for the lawyer. Like, he's covering up the fact that he's just a bad lawyer and doesn't really care about people. So he's just like, oh yeah, no, he's totally alive. He's just over in London. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, that's because none of these people care sincerely about any of these other people.
So you think maybe he talked to the police when he was initially questioned and he was just like, oh yeah, he's totally still alive over there. And then rather than like being serious about anything, he said that and then he just believed his own falsity.
Perhaps. I mean, mistaken identity is one of the tent poles of this film, of people not sincerely caring who they're talking to, and everyone's seemingly blending into one another so well that someone can be mistaken for somebody else very easily. And that happens several times throughout the course of the film. So in that last moment where Patrick Bateman in his confession is mistaken for someone else, it is just another example of that occurring in there. And there were, you know, people mistakenly identifying Paul Allen being in London the entire time. So
you think he actually killed him and people are just like, people don't care.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the part that I always have to come back to is that, you know, everything after the stray cat seems so over the top and ridiculous with the cop cars blowing up and the helicopters and stuff. Like, is he
taking me the flashlight out the
right?
Set
exactly.
Window.
So flashlight against the translate. So is it just that he's spiraling after he like commits to this like separate personality and breaks it off with Reese Witherspoon? So he's no longer pretending to be one of the herd. He's officially embracing his craziness. Like, where does that fit in here?
In terms of execution, this could be a little tighter and less over the top. But basically, yeah, he's. His mask is slipping, and like part of this whole thing has been seeing how much more he could get away with each and every time that he committed one of these horrible things that he was doing. And so in the final moments of the film, when he's been able to get away with lots of stuff, he just keeps getting away with things until he's so panicked by the fact that he's done so much that he calls his lawyer to do the confession. Even his lawyer turns him away the next day in the bar after all this stuff, and he's so concerned, and he just sits there and he realizes that there's, you know, nothing else to it. Like, I can do whatever I need to do. I can be whoever I need to be. There are no real consequences for me because of what and who I am, in this moment.
So in his little final crazy person monologue there, when he's talking about how his pain is constant and sharp and he wants to inflict it on everyone else and et cetera, is that just because, is that still going back to him trying to conform and trying to be the best generic white guy he can be and not being that great? And he's just frustrated that no matter what he does, he's always going to be the same thing. Is that why he's angry?
I don't know if he is lashing out because he's frustrated that he's always going to be considered a loser. I think he's lashing out because he does have that insecurity. But I think that he also realizes in that final moment that this is also the perfect cloak for this. This is the perfect cover up for this, that he can be as awful as he wants to be. And that there are going to be no real consequences for him as long as society just looks the other way. because he's too important.
Well, but he seems to be upset by that. It almost seems like he wants to be caught. He wants to be punished so there can be some sort of resolution to his insanity.
Right. Yeah, and that's why he goes through the confession with his lawyer, but that doesn't go anywhere. But he's not willing to go to the police and confess or anything like that. He's not willing to do anything direct in that regard. So he doesn't want to outright be caught. He wants, I think part of it is the thrill of the experience that he's in. Because he doesn't seem to want to directly go straight to jail by walking into an NYPD precinct at any point. I'm sorry, a Toronto precinct at any point. But
it's just when he says things like, yeah, you know, there's no catharsis or whatever, it sounds like he's not going to get any resolution from getting caught. He's no longer getting the satisfaction from killing people, which is why he keeps upping the stakes. So he's just sitting there angry because he can never, like, satisfy his bloodlust, and also he's not going to be able to pivot that into something else by getting caught and dealing with it a different way?
Yeah. I mean, why would you think it would need to be a fulfilling ending for him?
Well, okay, so, all right, the first part is laying out what we think actually happened here, and if we're going to buy in to this direction and say, all right, he did all these things. He didn't get caught. Privilege, self-interest for everyone around him, all that stuff. Then we come back to, you know, I have sticking points with, like, okay, clearly he's medicated, and clearly some of this stuff was underlying issues from the very beginning, and it's stuff like somebody else's business card being nicer than his, and somebody getting a reservation at a place that he can't get a reservation that kind of, like, makes him angry and pushes him over the edge a little bit. But, like, at what point do we see satire that we can use for anything? Because if we're just watching a mentally unstable person, like, losing his mind and killing people, then I think the satire starts to fall apart at that point, unless you're just saying, like, he's a crazy guy and he's killing lots of people, but also he's never going to get caught because he's a rich white guy. Like, that's very much like an undertone to the rest of the plot, that it doesn't feel like that's the main focus of the satire, I guess.
I disagree a little bit. I feel like that is the focus of the satire, is that he can't fit in. He feels insecure. He's in a society that pressures him to fit in. Not only feels that pressure to fit in, he also feels the need to pressure other people to fit in. When he's committing many of those murders, it is against people who have lesser status, lesser education, lesser means than he has. And he feels power in those moments where he can exploit that over them. And that highlights the ways in which he's not a complete person, and he has these flaws, and that many other people in real life can't fit in and do lash out when they are under those circumstances. So I see the satire in that he's pressured into being this certain way, and he just snaps, and bad things happen. And the way that he's pressured into being is not a good thing. Like, they're like, not just Patrick Bateman, but his friends are all horrible people.
Right, but we're not assuming that his friends are also murdering people to get their rocks off because they're unsatisfied with their lives, are we?
No. But they aren't insecure like he is. Because remember, everybody who mistakes Patrick Bateman for somebody else always refers to Patrick Bateman's face about what a dork Patrick Bateman is. And
it's because he is a dork. I mean, like, although you can even see that he doesn't even believe the things that he's repeating. Like, when they're at that first dinner and he's going off on that long thing about ending apartheid and, you know, feeding the homeless and all that other stuff, people are, like, you know, poking fun at him and saying, like, all right, whatever, buddy. And then, you know, if you looked at his face, they would see that, like, he doesn't even believe this stuff. He just thinks that this is what he's supposed to believe at this day and age to be the right version of himself or something. But he's a dork because that's all he repeats. But I don't know. Like,
so many of his monologues that he has that he repeats in those moments where he's trying to sound smart, where he's trying to sound like he has a handle on things, are all assimilated from various things he's read. Like, you can tell from the way he phrases things about, you know, their earlier works and whatever. Like, he's been reading up on these things. He doesn't have the particular capacity to critique music in the way that he does. He doesn't have...
I mean, by the time he gets to Whitney Houston, he seems a little impassioned.
Well, I mean, I think he's under the influence of something. But there's also... when he's talking, like you said, about Sri Lanka, and he goes out of his way to stress the parts of the information that he feels like he has correctly interpreted from the news that he has watched, he feels smarter than everybody else, and he feels like he has control over the situation. And I believe that I have, you know, seen people like that in the real world who are very insecure in themselves, and so they love to broadcast all of the knowledge that they have.
I don't know, though, but the look that he gets at the end of that, when people, you know, when what's his name from Silicon Valley says whatever, how very caring of you or whatever,
thought
he just
provoking.
Does like a
yeah
it just says like he makes a little nod like, yeah, I know, like, yeah. it's or just like a sure, whatever kind of thing. Like, he doesn't seem to be buying his own crap to the point that I feel like he would be like, yeah, look what I just did. I just made a big statement and all of you should respect me now. And I don't know. I mean, this is minor quibble. So, but getting back a little bit more towards the satire stuff, like the problem I have is just that if we're trying to satirize some of these things, we need to be able to like take the point and make it a little bit broader to apply it to a larger audience or a larger concept. And we can't really apply him to other people because he's clearly insane, whether or not it's the pressure of just society that made him insane or not. But like, none of these other people are losing their minds. So the conformity that they're abiding by, which is the same thing he's trying to do, didn't make them insane. We just happen to be focusing on this one guy. Well, who's insane?
No, let's remove the word insane from this. Like, there, he is a murderer, but we don't really. None of these other people seem to be especially. How should I put this? They don't seem to be completely happy and content with themselves in the world that they are in. In particular, Samantha Mathis's character. She plays the, you know, best friend of his girlfriend, the best friend of his fiance, who he's having an affair with, and she's always on drugs. And her final scene in the film is potentially about her not being around after Easter because of reasons, which you know, are pretty. I would say. The interpretation is open, but I would say that she is perhaps going to, she's so unhappy that she is perhaps considering not being around any longer after that. You can see her self-destructive behavior manifest in all of the scenes that she's in. And you can see, the behavior of, characters like, Justin Theroux's, Timothy, Bryce. He's not well either, but he just has things just a little bit more together than Christian Bale's Patrick Bateman. He is the only like smart, funny friend, etc. that Christian Bale says that he has, and so that he doesn't really care that he's having an affair with Reese Witherspoon, who plays his fiance.
Well, okay, mm-hmm. I'm still with you. Do you think another portion of this is it's subtle, but basically, I don't know. Maybe it's about the world that they're trying to build, or maybe it's about the character they're trying to build. It seems like Patrick doesn't do anything at work, and I don't know if that's because this is a business where all of the rich higher ups don't actually do anything, or if it's because he in particular is not skilled and has a job simply because he has connections to the company. He, is part of it because he has additional failures, insecurities, inadequacies because he doesn't do anything and his coworkers do? Is that why they're potentially less wild cards, crazy people than he is?
I mean, they... We don't.
Do you think they do more work than he does, I guess is the question.
I mean, it's possible. I would assume so, but it doesn't... I would say that not really... I would say there's not really a lot of work that happens in this place. This is supposed to be a satire of 1980s New York corporate culture. You know, you got your guys in suits who all are, you know, doing various drugs and are more concerned with reservations about exclusive restaurants and experiences that they can have outside of the office space. You know, you can draw a parallel between that and like the hoodie wearing SF experience of the Silicon Valley people of nowadays, and their desire to have exclusive restaurant experiences. But that's the thing, is like it's all meetings and getting accounts and just talking and having lunches and, you know, stuff. It's not. They don't sit there and like open Excel. That's not part of their jobs.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that makes it tougher for me then, because that takes one potential personality trait off the table. If none of these people are really doing any real work, none of them should really necessarily feel particularly fulfilled, which probably is the case. But again, I mean, we're still focused on the crazy guy who's murdering people.
Well, the most famous scene of this film is the business card scene.
Yes.
And
I watched that link that you posted earlier, too, with the director talking about it.
Yeah. Mary Harron describes every thought that they had about, you know, they were going to have Japanese samurai swords because it was going to... The sword duel, of course, is evocative of the kind of... dueling that she wanted
pacing
to
contest.
A pacing contest that she wanted to evoke in that scenario, and about how none of their cards are really that different from each other is a point that they all obsess over these incredibly minor things and have nothing but insecurity in their lives.
I like Lewis's. His had color to it.
Yeah, well, Lewis is potentially, well, let's just say Lewis is gay, so he has some flair in his life. He's hiding his flair under a bushel right now, but I'm sure later in his life he will have experienced something.
He's hiding it in a Jean-Paul Gaultier overnight bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, but in the actual like business card comparison scene, because Lewis's doesn't come till later in the film. In the business card,
he's just the guy there going, "You all right? You're sweating. Why are you so worked up about somebody's business card?"
Yeah, which is the question that the audience has, is like, why would anyone care about this? Why would it matter? But people obsess over these very performative status symbol things about business, and so I find that scene incredibly hilarious. And I know it's not just me, that everybody generally seems to find that scene hilarious. So I don't think there's any real disagreement there. But it is an expression of the insecurity and dissatisfaction that these people have in their lives, that they're so focused on these tiny pieces of dead tree pulp that they can get embossed a certain way with Cillian Rail and Roman type. And you like that color? It's bone. So
I have a very nice business card too.
I don't have a business card. Do you really have a business card?
Yeah, I do have a business card. I don't really give much of them out, but I have one.
Can you send me a photo of your business card? I've never received a business card from you.
So. I usually forget to take them places. I got them from an internet thing, and like they have.
Is it Moomoo cards?
It is, yeah. they have like the regular ones, which are way too flimsy, and I got that one time just real quick, and then I got the thicker ones, which have like a little color thing in them, which are kind of cool, but they're like way too thick. Like you could hurt somebody with these cards.
Can you take a photo of it? Take a photo of your Moomoo card.
Well, it's over there. I'm trying to just find the file. I don't know. I haven't looked at this. Where is, let me just do business card. Nope, that's not my business card. That's not my business card. It's in here somewhere. I'll find it. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
It's an okay business card. There it is.
Okay. Does it have serif lettering on a off-white background?
It is sans serif.
Oh, trendy.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to remember. I think, I don't know if I did San Francisco on this or if it's it's a PDF. I can't dump a PDF into Skype, can I?
No, you could, but you could take a photo of it, which is what I want to see. I want to see the texture of the paper. You can't see that in PDF.
Oh, God. Then I have to go all the way over there. My microphone doesn't
reset.
Okay,
we'll do this later. It's not really the point. I'm just entertained by the notion that you have this. But the
most people have business cards if they have a business.
Well, I mean, I don't work in a business. I don't work in a profession where it would benefit me even remotely to have a business card. So I always have found it interesting when people obsess over business cards. Mm-hmm. That goes back to the little mat. Is it?
That's the front and back. That's just the graphic.
Hmm. Just kind of looks like a bird.
It's a business card. Looks like what?
Looks like a bird. It's got like a little beak, and then it's got like a big cartoon eye. It's like an anime bird.
The front or the back?
The front. is that the back?
The part that has my name on it is the front.
Okay, well, you didn't annotate which one was the front. Yes. Okay.
You're saying my logo looks like a bird?
Kind of look. I mean, with the embossing part of it, where you just see
it's
the shadow.
It's just like ghosts, ghosted or whatever.
Yeah, you just see the shadow. You just get like a little bird face.
All right, now I have to change my logo. You said it looks like a bird face.
Yeah, a sore bird. So, bird sore. Oh, God.
The A is the only part about that logo that I actually like. Anyway, moving on.
I'm getting very
sweaty over talking about my business card.
But you obviously felt compelled to have a business card, and to have it look a certain way to represent you. Like, it was part of your identity to make it look good enough. Like, you obviously didn't just, like, scribble out your name onto some torn up pieces of paper. So you do care in some way about this. It is a performative thing that you also participate in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm assuming that you don't murder people.
You're assuming, are you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've never seen you not murder anybody, so.
That's accurate, I suppose.
Well, no, actually, I have seen you not murder anybody. I haven't seen you not murder anybody. That would be true.
See, that's how they get you.
Yeah, it's the double negatives. It's all about the insecurity and mocking the performative masculine showmanship thing that they all seem to want to do to one another. Like the very beginning scene of this film is the beautiful opening credits with the drops of raspberry coolie, which look like blood. Mm-hmm. And then which I love the opening titles, by the way. I don't love the Lionsgate logo. That looks like garbage.
Why does it look so bad?
I don't know. It looks, it is just seriously some video toaster 1992 stuff. I don't know what is happening, but the Lionsgate logo is hideous. The opening titles are beautiful. And then you get to Timothy Bryce, complaining that this is a girls' restaurant that they're in. It's not masculine. It's not Dorsia. It's not the premier thing. And restaurants that you go to is also a status symbol. It's also pissing match contest to see who can get in where. And, if you can get in, with good reservations and stuff like that. And like that's all a performative aspect of this as well for who has the most status. And people compete for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nowadays we have Open Table, but
Paul Allen got a Friday night reservation at Dorsia.
Just lucky, I guess. But the sort of insecurity is part of what makes our main character in this, Patrick Bateman, so insecure, and also what makes him eventually crack because he can't deal with this world. But it's still a send-up of the world that he is in. Like, this movie is not saying all of these people are normal and he's just the one weirdo. Like, they're all weird. They're all bad. none of the other people are murderers, but none of these other people are good people.
Right. I mean, okay, so I guess I can see the parts where the social pressures and the person he's supposed to be combined with him cracking and becoming a murderer can lead to these very awkward, uncomfortable prostitute sex murder scene things. Oh. Because it's just...
I have to say, those are the weakest parts of the film.
Yes, they are. But mm-hmm. the thing is, like, in terms of where his personality would break and how it would come out, those make sense. The things like, you know, the cats and the helicopter and the exploding cop car, that stuff is just more out there and seems to be less representative of the issues he's dealing with in terms of just the actual topics and the social pressure, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree that it, like I said earlier, that is over the top. And you do start to question whether or not this was real because it's so ridiculous at that point.
But the way they talk about women, you know, being objects and being stupid and, you know, you're always supposed to find hot chicks or whatever. There's no such thing as a smart or talented woman. Like, all of the idiotic misogyny, if you were to then snap and turn into a psycho, those scenes make sense for the personality. The rest of these other things seem a bit odd. So when he starts to lose it there, that seems to make sense. But then, you know, I guess hitting Paul Allen in the face with the axe, that makes sense too.
Yeah. And... Well, and then that over-the-top moment, like I said, I believe that the events of him doing these things have happened in the film. There's, of course, the Feed Me the Stray Cat thing, which no ATM would really say. So that's...
Sure.
That's obviously... He's not fully there, and he's at the very least an unreliable narrator in that regard, where
at some point, yeah, something shifts, and our perspective needs to shift with it, and presumably it's the Feed Me the Stray Cat, because it is a pretty blatant statement that things are no longer necessarily real.
Right. But he does place that call, and he does talk to his lawyer, and he does go to the apartment, and it's been cleaned out, and the lady steps back into the shadow in a really creepy way because it wasn't listed in the Times. And
do you think he shot the doorman and then the janitor person, or is that part of that moment where his brain went into overload?
I think he probably did, but it is...
So that means you think he also shot at the cops and the helicopter was, in fact, chasing him, sort of.
Yeah, but you can't really shoot a cop car and have it explode like that from a gunshot. So it does, like, maybe that didn't explode, would be my guess. But I believe that he has committed these murders that he is confessing to. I don't believe that that's fake, necessarily. But he to go back to the murder of Paul Allen, which you had alluded to earlier with the axe, that is also one of the scenes that is, I would say, iconic to this. Is that a raincoat? Yes, it is.
Where he's dancing like a crazy person and shaking his arms about and
ridiculous. He took some stuff. Yeah, that's a really interesting scene, because he takes Paul Allen, this person who he considers to be his superior, and competition, and to be the top dog, etc. And he wants to take him down, and so he takes him to Texarkana, and he's been confused with Marcus Halberstam this whole entire time, so he just keeps pretending to be Marcus Halberstam. And he goes through with all of the stuff to get Paul Allen drunk, take him back to his apartment where he's lined the floor with newspaper. Paul Allen asks if he has a little dog, a chow or something. And he says, no, Allen. So he smacks him in the face with an axe and says, try getting a reservation at Dorsia now.
I'm surprised he didn't call Dorsey and pretend to be Paul Allen at one point in this movie.
That would have seemed like a more logical approach to certain things, but he doesn't. And for all we know, Paul Allen might not actually be capable of getting those great reservations at Dorsia. That might all have been performative as well, because we don't necessarily see him there doing anything. So
I don't know. He's got the nicer apartment. He's mm-hmm. got the nicer card. So it seems like he is just the better version of Patrick Bateman, which infuriates Patrick Bateman.
Yeah, which is why he feels the need to kill him, apparently.
apparently, yeah. Well, also, because at the dinner thing, he drops the name of his actual girlfriend, and Paul Allen knows who Patrick Bateman is and thinks he's a dork.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
He thinks he knows who he is.
Yeah. And and that's one of the few scenes where people talk to Patrick Bateman's face about what a dork Patrick Bateman is. So, yeah.
Which is weird, because you think if he's able to, like, fake and be these other people's, he could put on this, like, fake persona as his Patrick Bateman to, like, you know, make Paul Allen want to have dinner with Patrick Bateman? I don't know.
Well, how would that work out, Dan?
Well, if everyone thinks he's a dork, but then also thinks he's somebody else, if he were able to say... If he were able to put on the non-dorkiness that people will hang out with and be Patrick Bateman, he wouldn't be chastised as being a dork anymore. I don't know.
Well, I mean, while he's been confused for somebody else, I don't think he could very easily talk up Patrick Bateman, then walk out to the restroom, then come back and say, oh, did you see Marcus Halberstam? He just left.
He would have to get himself a new set of Oliver People's glasses to sort of, like, reset himself in people's minds.
Yeah, and like Mary Harron said in that narrated moment, everybody is supposed to look the same. It was all on purpose, production design wise. They all have Oliver People's glasses. They all have Valentino suits. They all have the same haircut. So it's easy to confuse them with enough, I guess, distance and lack of familiarity. So that's what makes the whole maneuver that he does work.
Because Paul Allen confuses Josh Lucas for somebody else in the business card scene, as pointed out by the director, which mm-hmm. I never noticed before.
Yeah. I noticed that previously, but it definitely was not my first viewing that I picked up on that one.
I mean, aside from Timothy Bryce, I don't really know the names of any of these other people.
No. Timothy Bryce and then McDermott is Josh Lucas, right?
Yes. And yeah. Then Bill Sage is David Van Patten.
Okay. And then Silicon Valley American Horror Story guy is Lewis.
Yeah.
But they all look similar-ish, sort of, except for, I would say, Bryce and Lewis. Josh Lucas just looks like Josh Lucas, no matter what. Just like, oh, hey.
He's got a very, very defined hair thing going on there.
Yeah, yeah. When you see Josh Lucas, you know you're either watching American Horror Story, I'm sorry, American Psycho, or Stealth. So those are your two options.
Or Sweet Home Alabama.
Yeah. You see, American Psycho is a precursor to Sweet Home Alabama because...
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, when Renee... When Reese Witherspoon is rejected by Josh Lucas... rejected by Patrick Bateman, she can then go back and reunite with Josh Lucas in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived happily ever after, making Lightning Glass.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that movie. What are you talking about?
I hadn't seen that movie until last Christmas. I was at my mom's house and she was watching it, and it was the Lightning Glass scene where she's in, like, the studio and she's, like, marveling at it. And
oh,
then,
yeah.
What is it?
It's very subtle.
Candace Bergen walks in as, like, the mom, and she's awful. Uh-huh.
Yeah, Candace Bergen is who's the other guy?
I don't remember. she's supposed to be the mother-in-law, but then they don't get married or something, and then they smack each other.
Of the other guy, I don't remember who. It's one of those guys with the funny names, isn't it?
Yeah, but the other guy is so understanding because
Patrick
that's what
Dempsey.
Yeah, that's what you want in this kind of a movie, is just some really understanding. Anyway, so this is not a Sweet Home Alabama podcast, but yeah, it's a weird movie. There's always his roles as the voice of Home Depot to fall back on, I guess.
Stealth was another one of those ones that was I'm more familiar with the VFX breakdowns of the movie than anything else, because that was a big, I think that one was all over NAB when I first started going to NAB, like, look what we did with our, I don't know, flames and our fusions and stuff.
Well, I thought that was a Digital Domain property.
I don't know.
Oh, because I think it was Digital Domain, and Digital Domain was like, yay, look at us. We're great. And then everybody's like, okay, fine, whatever. It's just
you made an airplane.
A dumb robot plane. We don't care. Because I don't believe stealth really took the world by storm, is what I'm going to say.
yeah, look at that, Digital Domain, stealth.
See, I remember things.
I forget the Digital Domain has a website. Oh, it's not black anymore.
Oh, it's not black with white text on it?
It's white with black text. Oh, my God, what has happened over there?
The world's turned upside down now.
Somebody got fired.
Well, I mean, yes, and three bankruptcies.
It says they create experiences that entertain.
Mm.
They have originals, feature films, commercials, virtual reality, virtual humans, including Tupac, and they have an app.
Get
the app, vr.digitaldomain.com. They have a VR app. Why do they have a VR app?
Because everybody has a VR app, because VR is the future, according to 2 years ago. People haven't course corrected on that yet.
All right, Digital Domain.
Mm.
Anyway, what were we talking about? American Psycho.
Yeah, American Psycho.
So, all right, so the 80s were terrible. white privileged people all wanted to be like Paul Allen. Some were better than others. Some were mentally unstable in the first place and began murdering people in this film as a result of the insane pressure to conform and to be liked and to fit in. And despite all of that, there is no resolution. He's not going to be caught because the world is indifferent to the atrocities he's committed, because they care more about reservations and property values than murder, because there are a lot of people in New York and he has a fancy suit.
Yeah. Well,
is that it?
Sort of, except for all of the sarcastic garbage that you had. But this isn't really a movie about like him having an arc as a character. Like he's not the protagonist. He's not the hero of this. Like he's awful. Like he's a bad person.
Right. The point is that he doesn't have an arc because the world doesn't care, and the world is not going to make him have an arc if he doesn't have an arc on his own.
But like the movie doesn't start
arc
with
yourself.
He doesn't. It's man versus self. And he doesn't have a backstory. It's not like, oh, my dad, you know, was mean to me. Like that's not there. He doesn't have a future direction that he's really going in, because he terminates his engagement. He doesn't suffer any consequences. Everything's just going to keep going as the status quo. The status quo is a big deal. Despite everyone's attempts to influence what the status quo is in the film by trying to get ahead, they all kind of seem to be about the same level at the beginning and at the end.
So it's really just, since he's 27 years old in the movie, it's really just about that like post-college existential dilemma that most people have, except his leads him to killing a lot of people.
Yes, but I can tell from your tone that you think that's just dumb. So
I still don't know what this movie is saying that I'm supposed to feel.
That these
social pressures and white people are bad? Like, I get that.
Yeah, but that's it. Like, and murder is not good either. But that's
right, but like,
yeah,
we're not gonna make a whole movie about how the sky is blue or something.
No, but I mean, this is a satire of these people in these circumstances, in this era, and a satire of the era itself. Like, it's not real. Like, these aren't really people who are going through and experiencing things that correlate to reality. They're all just kind of an assemblage of what the quote-unquote yuppies were in the 80s. A send up of that and of the materialistic, narcissistic complexes that people had in the 80s. not that we have those anymore. but that's basically it. And that people who are insecure will lash out against other people who they feel to be less than them, and there's a social divide, class divide that they want to see enforced, and that people who are on one side get special treatment, or not even special treatment, but are just not even considered threats in certain ways, in certain circumstances.
It's simply not possible, to quote his lawyer.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, maybe one of the reasons
when tragic things happen, and they do happen, and a white guy does it, then it is usually like, oh, you know, this was a good person, and there were no signs, and, like, everything was fine, and, like, all this stuff was great, and he had a promising future until blah, 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 and he definitely wasn't a terrorist, but then you can contrast that with the treatment of other people who are not from that sort of a background, and there are different things that are written up about them, and it's not hard to see how you could come up with that sort of satire in this film.
Yeah. I suppose a bit of a contrast between those two things in the movie would have helped me, but it's not necessary, obviously, to make the point. So yeah, I get that.
If they had an A story and a B story, and the B story was some murderous person who was from a lower social standing and lower class, who was just going around getting caught by the police and stuff through the whole first act of the film.
I mean, no, they could do something as, it would be very dumb, but like literally off the top of my head, they could do something as dumb as that when they're watching the TV in the bar there with Reagan or whatever the hell they were watching.
Yeah, it was Reagan.
My memory served me there. It could be a news story about somebody getting arrested for murdering a bunch of people in an apartment and then not naming the apartment and then just having a picture of somebody who is clearly much less privileged than they are. But, like, that's a terrible version of that, but they could have done something there.
It's possible. Yeah. Anyway, I feel like Reagan is his own satire, so, you know, there's that.
Totally. I don't know. Whatever, sure. I guess one of the things that I think contributes to the reason I have difficulty getting into these people is that by necessity, like, their ambition is to be this sort of, like, well-defined, shallow person. And when they lack any sort of emotional depth, you find it hard to care about any of them. So, I mean, which is kind of the point too, but
yes,
it works against itself in the fact that I don't care about any of the people to the point that it's just like, oh, look at that. There you go. That was a movie.
Okay. I mean,
and I think, you know, he when he does start to break at the end there and you do start to see something underneath, whether it's through the lens of stuff that probably didn't happen, like the cat, or whether it's just him, like, being sweaty and, you know, kind of losing it and on the phone there, that's when you're starting to see a little bit of depth to his personality, and that's when you can start to get in there a little bit. But then at this point, it doesn't matter anymore, and it doesn't help because that depth is wasted on just showing a breakdown. It doesn't really give us any additional useful insight into his personality. It's just like, you know, we've gone along on this ride and we see where he is at the end of the movie. It's just, that's the only time that we have the opportunity to see underneath the surface.
Well,
it can't all be drugs and discotheques, I mean, you know?
Well, we do see under the surface when he feels pressure when he's being interviewed or meeting with Willem Dafoe's character, the investigator who's been hired. Because Willem Dafoe is someone that he considers to be a threat, who's someone who's on a social standing that he feels threatened by. This is a guy in a suit who comes into his office, who knows about Huey Lewis in the news, who is well-versed in restaurants and things, and he feels inferior to him. And you can see the glossy flop sweat every time that he talks to Willem Dafoe.
He's very shiny through a lot of this movie.
Yeah. And if you love close-ups on Willem Dafoe's face, this is the movie for you. But they do a good job of getting you that tension in these moments where it's just two people sitting across from each other with a table in between, either his desk or a table at a restaurant, and talking across it to one another. You cut back and forth. And then you just punch in on super, super mega close-ups on their faces when it's supposed to be the most tense that it's supposed to be. You get some of the feeling that he feels threatened, that he feels remorse, that he feels like he's caught. But at the same time,
that's another weird thing, though, because Willem Dafoe is outside potentially. He's outside the social pressures of the group that Patrick Bateman is in, and he's very clearly smarter than the situation. Like, it's very obvious that Patrick Bateman is hiding something or guilty, and Willem Dafoe knows that. But basically, that lunch scene there is saying, like, hey, this other guy vouched for you, so you're fine. But why would he let him off the hook like that?
Because he doesn't have anything that he could really task this person of status with that would actually mean anything. I don't know how Willem Dafoe treats other people that he's interviewing, because it's not a profile of Willem Dafoe's character.
But he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would be like, well, I got my paycheck and somebody vouched for you, so I guess we'll never know.
Well, he does have that line that, you know, to think one of his own friends would have killed him for no reason whatsoever is ridiculous. And that is, of course, a ridiculous thing to think, because there seems to be no motive. There seems to be no real connections between anybody. But at the same time, this person seems to have disappeared.
Plus, even if he were to pry in their relationship, or, you know, talk to the other people at Pierce and Pierce and say, like, was there any sort of jealousy or resentment, they probably wouldn't even have remembered the business card incident, because they're so self-absorbed that they would be like, no, everybody liked everybody. It was fine.
Yeah, and, like, people get confused for other people. The meeting that was written down is from Marcus Halberstam. There is no real evidence other than he was an incredibly nervous person. So there was nothing really to act on in that situation. But you don't find that satisfying, because
no, I don't.
Yeah, you want to see Willem Dafoe just, like, put him in cuffs and then escort him.
I want to see
scene.
So. I guess I want to see Willem Dafoe go, I know what you did, I can't prove it, so, you know, I'll catch you later or something. But it's more like, oh, well, what are you going to do? Like, that's life. But I don't know. He seems to be, like, the least self-obsessed person in the movie, so it would stand to reason that he would, you know, show his cards a little bit more or something. I don't know.
Well, but then you don't have the ending that you have where he has no real consequences for his behavior, even if he wanted to have those consequences. So that's kind of part of that. And like we said, there was no real reason why he could, you know, hold him or anything. Like, he's just a private investigator that was hired to look into this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think of the performance here of Chris June Bale as our psycho?
I think he does a great job of being crazy and unstable. Unstable, that's not a word. Unstable and sweaty and fit. And they look good in a suit. Like, I think he does all the things that his character is supposed to do. I think he's good.
Yeah, well, apparently Christian Bale had been up for this and then lost the role, and Leonardo DiCaprio was going to do it, and then he got it back, and then it was between him and Ewan McGregor, and he pleaded with Ewan McGregor to let him have the role, and so he finally got this. He did training prior to the film, like 3 weeks worth of training, and then he finally did a personal trainer training that the movie actually paid for prior to the filming occurring, so that he could be in the appropriate shape for what he felt like the narcissistic Patrick Bateman would look like. So this is, of course, the start of Christian Bale's long running career of altering his body in order to fit roles and destroy his liver, I'm assuming. like he seems
He's committed.
Yeah, he seems very committed. It also maybe potentially not entirely healthy, but
I think it was useful in this role. I think it added to his character.
Yes, yes, but let's say other dramatic gaining and losing of things has perhaps had a toll taken on him, but he turns in a good performance here. I feel like he's appropriate for what this character is, and he established himself, I would say, as somebody that you would want to cast in a movie, because prior to this, he was in, like, what, Newsies and Empire of the Sun, neither of which I believe he is remembered for, necessarily. Was it Velvet Underground, where he's, Goldmine. Like, a David Bowie fan?
Velvet Goldmine?
Yes, Velvet Goldmine, that's it. Velvet Underground is different. Velvet Goldmine...
yeah, I guess I didn't realize that this was a sort of a breakout role for him.
Yeah, so this really set him on his path to be Batman, to be an American Hustle, your favorite film.
Such a bad movie. What do you think of his morning regimen?
I find it hilarious, and it's not hilarious because I feel like it is implausible. I believe it is hilarious because he's very seriously committed to this regimen, because it's just absurd. I like little character moments, like when he's at the dry cleaners and he's shouting and screaming and saying all these awful invectives to the dry cleaners, and the girl that he may have dated at some point walks in, and he has to try to put on the little mask of social appropriateness and then somehow get out of any sort of lunch engagement with her, where he's looking at his watch to determine whether or not he's available on a Saturday, is, I find, hilarious. But it is something where he walks the line of, I think, being funny and also a horribly serious for being a murdering unhinged human being, and apparently he was inspired by Tom Cruise, which is not too far, which is not too hard to believe.
In what way?
Cause apparently, he struggled with the role, according to Wikipedia. The actor struggled with the role until he noticed Tom Cruise in an interview on Late Night with David Letterman being struck by Cruise's energy and intense friendliness with nothing behind the eyes. Used Nicolas Cage's performance in Vampire's Kiss as an inspiration for the role. Filming began March 1999 in Toronto, Canada.
What is Vampire's Kiss?
I don't know. Let's find out. Vampire's Kiss is a 1989 American black comedy film directed by Robert Bierman and written by Joseph Mignon. It stars Nicolas Cage, Maria Conchita Alonso, and Jennifer Beals and Elizabeth Ashley. The film tells the story of a mentally ill literary agent whose condition turns even worse when he believes he was bitten by a vampire. It was a box office failure, but went on to become a cult film.
Oh, did it really?
Hard to believe from that log line that it would become a box office failure. But,
oh, wow. Vampire's Kiss. Budget $2 million. Box office $725,000. Not great.
Yeah. Can you imagine this with Leonardo DiCaprio in the role, though?
Leonardo DiCaprio circa 2000. What had he been in?
The Man in the Iron Mask, I believe, was a contemporaneous film with this.
It's not a real movie. So let's see, 2000. Yeah, it said he went on to do The Beach. So previously, Titanic era, a couple, like 3 years later. So I feel like I could see it. It would be very different, and he would bring a very different intensity to the role, but I could see it.
If we just be like a little, I mean, let's just say it. Leonardo DiCaprio looked rather youthful in that time period. So this would have been like a teen committing murder through the whole film. So I feel like he would not have been appropriate casting.
He's supposed to be 27 years old.
Yeah, but not a teen. So, and in the book, he's actually older.
Yeah, I'm looking at photos of him from the beach. They would have had to defrost his tips and...
don't think you can
get rid of that necklace that he's wearing.
Yeah, just throw Leonardo DiCaprio in the microwave and set it to defrost.
If they gave him the same haircut that he's got that Christian Bale's got in this movie, I think he would fit the role.
Leonardo DiFrostio. Just DI capital S.
Somebody's working for a title there. All right, I'll write it down for you.
No, don't.
Leonardo DiFrostio.
No, but you know, this is also the first movie I remember seeing Chloe Sevigny in. I'm not a huge Chloe Sevigny fan, I will say that, but she does a very believable job as being this very earnest secretary who fancies her boss, but doesn't really want to super act on it, but is flattered by his advances. So she good for her, I guess. It's kind of weird. It's a weird role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She does.
And also,
well,
for being a movie written by two women, I don't think this movie passes the Bechdel test. But
oh yeah. Boy. Yeah. No.
No.
Oh yeah, she was in Zodiac. She was Jillian wife.
Yep. You've seen her in other things.
I have. I'm trying to remember where.
She's in lots of things.
She's in things.
She's in things. Chloe Sevigny's in things and stuff. But this is a movie. And it has, I think, some very iconic and interesting moments in it, most notably the business card, mm-hmm. Second, the murder of Paul Allen, third, probably being Feed Me a Stray Cat on a ATM machine. There's some debate on that third one, I suppose.
So we're gonna take this movie as confusing satire of a certain period, and we're gonna hang it up on the bookshelf up there next to Fight Club and be like, well, there's a thing you did at a time.
Well, interesting that you should make that comparison, because I feel like both Fight Club and American Psycho have fans who don't necessarily think of the source material. Yeah, they don't get it. Who have fans who are like, yeah, Patrick Bateman. It's like, no, that's not the point.
Yeah, man, all those chicks and killing people and stuff is rad. No.
Yeah, no. And like with Fight Club people, it's always like, oh, yeah, Tyler Durden, so cool. It's like, no, this... What did you watch?
Spoiler. Yeah, so I mean, I think aside from just the time period and the delusions and mental illness stuff, I think there are other parallels to be made in this movie too. It's one of those ones that it does a lot of stuff. It's got some ambition, whether or not that's necessarily clear when you watch it, and there's a lot of interpretation. You can go a couple different ways.
And also, I must say that while we might have some disagreements about the execution and structure and stuff, I like Mary Heron's direction of many of the moments in this film. Like, I feel like that she did a good job, and it's kind of interesting that you would see this movie through her eye, whereas I feel like because the movie industry is predominantly male, and this is a movie about a man who murders a bunch of women, this would have been perhaps worse in a lot of ways had this been through the lens of a guy who didn't quite get it. Like, if this had been a Brett Ratner movie, I don't necessarily think that would have been a good thing. Not that he was in the running for it. It was discussions with Stuart Gordon, who's the reanimator guy, if you don't remember him. And then there's David Cronenberg, who's, I believe, a personal favorite of yours.
I don't think I have any particular feelings about Cronenberg, do I?
Well, do you like gore? And
I mean
stuff?
Sometimes.
Yeah. And apparently when DiCaprio was on it, he wanted a short list of replacement directors, including Oliver Stone, Danny Boyle, and Martin Scorsese. So
that's a very surprising list coming from Mr. DiCaprio there.
Yeah, shocking. But yeah, no. Apparently, all of that was bad. And then working from a new script written by Matthew Markwalder, Stone brought on board, whom Heron called probably the single worst person to do it. The director wanted to eliminate the satire from Heron's script, emphasizing the psychological character traits of Patrick Bateman. However, Stone could not agree on the film's direction with DiCaprio, who decided to star in The Beach instead. So it's a good thing for everybody involved that Stone and DiCaprio went on to do other things, because, I mean, this movie without any satire as being a straight exploration of the psychological character traits of Patrick Bateman as portrayed through Leonardo DiCaprio.
/ Oliver Stone. No, nobody would remember that movie. It would be very bad.
Yeah, that would be awful. But I feel like that this has a place in the canon, at least in terms of references and movies and things. Like, this comes up. You know, people remember it. It's despite its, you know, completely unimpressive performance of $34.3 million, and its direct to DVD sequel starring Mila Kunis as the daughter. like, this movie still has legs.
Whose daughter does she play?
I believe Patrick Bateman's daughter.
Oh God, does he know that he has a daughter?
I don't know. I've never watched the sequel. Dan,
maybe we should watch that. No. Yeah. Yeah, it's. I will agree with all of those things. I mean, I'm gonna think about it some more, see if I can figure out why it doesn't really hit any particular mark with me. In a way that Fight Club still kind of does, even though my opinion of Fight Club has certainly changed since I first saw it when I was young and impressionable. But it's a good movie. It does belong in you know, cultural references, etc. When we're talking about movies, Christian Bale was very good. Mary Harron's directing was good, except some of the camera work was not ideal.
Well, that was Andrzej Sekula, who was the DP for Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs and
I can see that
Pulp Fiction and Hackers.
There are just some scenes where they're like shooting, and then it seems like whoever's holding the camera may have like drifted off or like sneezed or something.
Well, I mean, I think part of that has to do with it being like a bulky film camera. They don't have like the smoothest movement on this.
Yes, and they had a very limited budget. I would like to acknowledge that. So I know, and again, there are a million reasons why you don't have the time and attention. But the performances and the actual directing of the characters was spot on.
Yeah, and, you know, while I mock the translites, which are the, for those not familiar, basically a giant photograph that is illuminated from behind that is supposed to simulate normally a cityscape or sky or something that you see outside of a window in a set. The ones in this movie, not so great, because they basically just shot an angle, and then all of the camera work is not from that angle. And they get really close and have raking angles on the characters, which is dramatic and interesting for the characters, but draws attention to the flat screen that's 3 feet behind the glass pane for the windows. So,
yeah.
That's another spot where it feels a little cheap. But I do appreciate the production design. I do appreciate the attention to detail and like music and costuming. So
All that stuff is really good. And, you know, I think the 80s is a great era to play with when you're doing, you know, satire / period stuff. Yeah, exactly. But even still, in spite of my preference for a lot of this stuff, this one misses the mark for me for some reason still.
Okay.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I guess I'll stop reviewing it on Letterboxd saying I don't get it. I guess I get it now. I just, like, I don't know.
It's fine. You don't have to. I mean, there is no pressure to really, like, love this movie. It's not on the AFI top whatever list. Like,
I think if you were in college in the early 2000s, there was a lot of pressure to like this movie.
Oh, well, I would agree with you because we watched this all the time. You remember how I told you that Across the Hall They would watch my friends across the hall would watch Bad Boys 2 all the time.
Uh-huh.
We would watch American Psycho in our room all the time.
Mm. So you guys were the American Psycho room. People could wander over, check out American Psycho, go check out, you know, some Bad Boys 2, and then just be about their merry way.
Yeah, and I feel like my roommates were those kinds of Fight Club American Psycho fans who don't necessarily appreciate that it is satire and that you should not necessarily laud these things. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not speak of them.
Yeah, you know, kids in college are really still growing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would be your Dorsia? Do you have a Dorsia that you can't get into? Or is just now, it's ruined now that we have Open Table. We can just be like, all right, I'll book it 2 months out. I don't care.
Well, no, I have no interest in really... this is an interesting thing, is that I have no interest in getting into any place that I can't get into. And I don't want to go
any... What does that mean?
Well, just that I don't covet.
Oh, you don't think Dorsey is a good place because the food's good? You think it's just a place to go because it's a place to go?
Yeah, I would say in Los Angeles, that place would probably be like Spago or something like that, where it's like a place to go and to be seen, etc. Now, I did go to Spago one time for my birthday, and the food was good. But let's just use that as an example anyway. Like, there are places that are considered exclusive or difficult to get into. And I could see perhaps coveting that, but it would be a status symbol of being able to get in, which I don't care about. Like, I mainly care about reservations in terms of I don't want to wait in a line for an hour to get into a place or to drive to a place.
Have a reservation.
Yeah, I don't want to drive to a place and find out that I got to wait or something like that. Usually it's just I go to places that you might have to wait. I've never walked into a place that has actually turned me away. So that's also another example of how I don't aim that high on the totem pole of restaurants that you can go to. Mm-hmm. I have been to some fancy ones, but it's all been just very casual reservation process. And if I can't get a reservation, then oh what, so well. It doesn't matter. Right. Now, do you ever get concerned?
It's Arizona, no.
Well, I just figured it'd be fair to ask.
I mean, I'm annoyed that Pizzeria Bianco doesn't take reservations.
Well, I'm also annoyed by that too, but the wait's never usually that bad, but for two people.
Oh, if you go the wrong time, it's 2 hours.
Oh, I have not done that.
Luckily, they bought the building next door and turned it into a bar where you can wait.
I've seen that last time we were there, when we were waiting.
In the day, you used to just have to stand in a line. Which is really awkward if you're like eating on the patio and there's a line of like 30 people just sort of standing there.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Awkward.
Plus there's two Pizzeria Biancos now, and he's got like other restaurants and stuff too, so whatever.
He's got the pasta one, right?
No, they have the same stuff.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait, well, I guess the other one does have more than just pizza, because the one downtown just does pizza, right?
Yeah. The other one, like they have pasta stuff, I think, is their selling point.
I think I've only been to the one downtown once in the past like 10 years. It's just, it's too far away and it's not worth the hassle.
Mm-hmm.
There are other places to get good pizza.
Okay.
I still don't go to those either because they're far away.
Yeah, I know. You just order your Pizza Hut.
I've been on a Domino's kick lately. They got a pan pizza. And Domino's has double cheese. You can get double cheese. You can get a double cheese pan pizza for $9 or something.
Okay. Well, I have a question for you. Is that cheese?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I had Domino's pizza back in the day. And part of the reason why I don't have Domino's pizza today is because I find it unpalatable. The cheese is waxen and not very cheese-like.
Well, it's melty, liquidy cheese when it's hot.
Yeah, and it browns, and then it turns into plastic.
No, see, you got to get the pan, though. The pan stays warm because it's thicker, and it's got a little better doughy consistency. And then you can load it up with whatever toppings you want, and then you get some hot sauce and some ranch, and you're good to go.
Hot sauce and ranch, Jesus. No, thank you.
I forget, you are not a hot sauce or ranch dipper for your pizza, neither?
No. See, with my pizza, I will put some crushed red chili flake on top.
Yeah, but it's dry and it gets all in your teeth and stuff.
It's not. No, you got to put it on when the pizza's hot. I mean, I don't do it to cold pizza. That would be ridiculous.
You're still eating flakes of chili. Like, what's wrong with putting hot sauce on it?
Because I don't... Those aren't, like, hot sauces that blend with the pizza. They don't become one with the pizza either. So what's the point? Like, with the chili flake, you get the heat from it, and it doesn't contribute excess moisture to the process. But I guess since you're having deep dish, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, if it's waxy cheese, maybe you want to add a little moisture to it. Or if it's too moist, then you go ranch, which is a thickener.
No.
You don't put the ranch on it, by the way. You gently dip in the ranch. It's delicious.
Oh, my throat closed up. I can't do that. I can't stomach the thought of ranch with it. Now, that's not saying that there aren't possible good applications, but they are not for me. You do you, as they say. You do you.
You can't shame me into not putting ranch and hot sauce on my pizza. It's not possible.
I mean, it was never my goal to persuade you to do anything other than this podcast. So you can do whatever you want.
So if I were to, like, say I demand that you put some ranch on a pizza or I quit the show, you would actually maybe try it?
No, because this is where I draw the line, is you can't make me do stuff because you're not the boss of me, and I can do what I want. You're not my real dad, is what I'm saying. So,
all right, fair enough. I mean, you know, if you don't eat your ranch pizza, then you can't have any dessert, whatever, but that's fine.
Well, that's fine, because I don't really like dessert that much.
Oh, for
surprise.
Sure. Well, you don't like anything, do you?
I do. I like mashed potatoes. I like pizza. I like good pizza. But I like the...
You like Fresno chilies. You like pineapple and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mean anyway, you make fun of me for my pineapple on my pizzas.
I do some pineapple sometimes. Wait, do you do the pineapple with the ranch? You can. I'm trying to think if I go ranch or if I go hot sauce on a pineapple pizza. I think I usually go ranch with the pineapple pizza.
Wow.
Yeah. You do some pineapple and salami and some double cheese and some ranch.
Who's Satan now, listeners?
Who's suburban now?